switch gears again. This is a great honor to have a combination of entomologists and pathologists. It's good to talk to people outside of your discipline sometimes. So this, the first speaker is Dr. Al Bell, coming from College Station. He's a legend, by the way.
I've been trying to get Gino and Dr. Liu to clone me so that I can do more work with more things here, because I need the extra energy of these young men that have been preceding me here. So I thank the audience for some excellent questions. You're asking the right questions. I wish I had the answers to all of them, but I can show you some answers to a few of them. There is a whole lot that we do not know in this general area. We started in 2003. I just want to thank a number of my colleagues. These will probably appear on the final published abstract as authors. But we've been cooperating with the scientists in the four southeastern states, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida, who, with Bob Nichols' assistance, have been sending us bowls since about 2003 every year so that we can monitor what's been going on there in association with insect damage. And in the last 3 or 4 years, we've had bowls coming both from plots sprayed intensively with insecticides to minimize insect damage and unsprayed plots so that we could compare the types of bole rot organisms occurring strictly in association with insects and which ones were being reduced by the use of insecticides. The insects here, you've already seen the pictures of them. We've worked with the three major stink bugs. Two of them that you haven't seen anything with, we've worked with the leaf-footed bug, and we've also worked with the cotton flea hopper. Now, we don't normally think of the cotton flea hopper as a cause of bole rots, but I'd like to convince you today that the major mode of action of the cotton flea hopper is a bole rot. It just happens to be that bole's in flower bud. But it's nonetheless the consequence of what happens to the ovary that makes this insect so damaging and causes a lot of fruit shed. The types of studies in 2003 and 2004, we started, I might just preface this a little bit. When I talk about internal bole rots, I'm talking about what others have referred to as seed rots, but rots of the seed or fiber within apparently green bowls, what appear to be green bowls externally. But when you cut into them, you find that the seed or the fiber is discolored or deteriorated. And I use this to distinguish our more classical bole rots, like Diplodia or Fusarium semitectum, Rhizopus, which have external symptoms on the bole wall as well as internal rotting, and are usually favored by bole worms and bole weevils. The internal bole rots, on the other hand, we're finding are largely associated with the feeding by hemipterous insects. The first studies we did in 2003 and 4, we did aseptic isolations of various parts of symptomatic unopened green bowls that were shipped to us from South Carolina and some that we had looked at in Texas. Again, we looked at the same sort of things in 2004, but in 2004, we also did isolations from locules that were puncture inoculated simply with the bath water of the insect vortex and sterile water. These were insects captured in pheromone traps, light traps, whatnot in the field or even by hand. They were simply vortexed in a couple mils of sterile water. We immediately took samples and plated and looked for microorganisms, and then we let them go overnight. So if the insects were in the waste product of the gut or whatnot, we'd have a chance of seeing those as well. And then the next day, we would take samples again and plate out and see what kind of organisms we found. These organisms, then we did stem puncture fine needle punctures with them, putting a droplet of them on the surface and then doing a fine puncture through them to see which ones had bole rot potential, and then confirm Koch's postulates on these. In more recent years, we've done isolations from locules of bowls caged with feral insects at various intervals. Here we collected the insects in the field, again using a variety of traps, going on to a variety of crops, and as Michael just was referring to, we've started a new study where they were shipping insects to us overnight from Georgia or the southern states, and then we cage them on clean bowls in the greenhouse at College Station and see what kinds of rots or problems develop. And finally, and Gene will deal more with this, we've done isolation from loculus of bulbs caged with laboratory reared insects fed microbial contaminated diets. In 2003, when we looked at the bulls from South Carolina, this is the spectrum of fungi we've seen in these associated with internal bull rocks. Fulma exigua, Verticillium nigrescens, were by far the most common fungi we found in this connection. We did find other fungi, Alternaria, Alternata, Fusarium semitectum, Curvularia lanata. More recent years, we found Fusarium verticillioides and Diplodia gossypina in some of these bulls as well. Just to show you what these look like, if we do a stem puncture inoculation with the spore suspension of these fungi, within about 7 days, you'll see the bowl is turning in largely into a stained, rotted mass. In the case of Fusarium semitectum, of course, we recognize this is a cause of external bowl rots as well. And you can see in this case, it rots the bowl, even though the inoculation was internal to start with, it rots the bowl so thoroughly it does end up spreading into the external tissues of the bowl as well. But these other fungi remain isolated within the bowl with no evidence of the rot right up until just a few days before the bowl starts splitting. Simply show you with Fulma exigua inoculations, for example, when the bowl opens, then it's obvious something happened inside. You have what I refer to call a tight lock. Others might call a hard lock. But the texture here is still somewhat soft to your touch, and you can gin this. You get what I like to call a true hard lock from bacterial infections. You're not going to get that through a gin. There's no way to fragment into 1,000 pieces. If you look at a lot of these locks, this shows again with Fulma how they compare to the healthy or normal lock in this, out of the same bowl. You see similar things with the other fungi. We also found the bacteria. We found a lot of Pantova agglomerans. There are two different types here, which you could distinguish based on their fatty acid profiles or other microbial tests. The taxonomy here is still somewhat in limbo, so I'm just going to call them type 1 and type 2. But from a sample of just 20 locks, you can see that 14 of those yielded Pantoa species. And in 2003 through 2006, Pantoa was a major actor, apparently, especially in the northern states of the southeast, but also in parts of Texas as well. As we move further south, as I'll show you later, other problems came into being. We also found Agrobacterium tumefaciens at that time. Of course, I was doing a lot of work with bronze wilt. We were wondering whether we used very selective media, but we were able to find Agrobacterium tumefaciens in some of these. And interestingly enough, the agrobacteria actually causes bull rot too. So we don't normally think of it as a bull rot pathogen. Simply showing what happens 7 days after you inoculate with Pantoa, you can see again the thorough rotting, very similar to what you see with the fungi, the thorough rotting of the seed, the discoloration of the fiber, showing you a couple degrees of it here. The PA RIF is a mark strain that we've used to study the epidemiology and the insect relationships of these bacteria. We select for a rifampicin variant, and then we can track this through the system. At maturity with Pantoa, you very frequently see this little black stripe that sits under the suture of the bowl. When you see these locks, some which may be very tight, but some with this black stripe, it's almost certainly a Pantoa infection somewhere between 10 days and 18 days into bowl development. If it happens earlier than that, it's going to rot the whole lock. If it happens later, you're only going to see little brown spots. In 2004, then, when we began looking at wash water, this is the sort of thing you saw. All these were done with 28-gauge needle punctures over the suture of the bowl, which puts you in the middle of the lock. You can see 7 days after, there was a little bit of brown necrotic tissue here with some exudate emerging from where we inoculated with the wash water. When we did aseptic surgery on the bull, this is what you saw. The inside of the lock was entirely rotted and broken down. Here you can see the suture of the bull part that we took off. There's increased browning up and down along that suture line, which corresponds with what we see with the bacterial infections. At maturity, again, this is what you see following these wash water inoculations. We then compared some of the wash water data, which is the right column, present in Texas insects, with those insects that we isolated, or Dan Klepfel and others at South Carolina isolated. And you see, basically, we're seeing mostly the same group. Now we were able to distinguish at least three different pantoagglomerans groups, which have been identified here simply as Pantoa, Sedecia, and Yersinia strains based on their fatty acid profile similarities. Interestingly enough, the bacteria that originally were identified as Sedecia and Yersinia based on fatty acid profile only are in fact pantoagglomerans. When you go to 16S rDNA analysis or the genetic probes, you find out these are in fact variants of pantoagglomerans. We also found Flavomonas oryzae habitans and Pseudomonas pedida, even Klebsiella pneumonia, the human strain. I mean, the same serotype as the human strain causing bull rot of cotton. And we not only found them in symptomatic bulls in the field, but also we recovered them from the insects that we washed. We established, there were questions earlier about bull age. We established there was a strong effect of bull age on the ability of pantoagglomerans to cause bull rot. Bulls that were inoculated at 1 to 5 days, there was 100% abortion because the bacteria infected all the locks. It spread from one lock to another and caused abortion of the bull. And of course, it caused 100% discolored seed, 100% dead embryos. As we aged, once we got to 8 or 9 days, you no longer suffered bull abortion from a single loccule inoculation. But you were getting still 100% discolored seed and 100% fiber discoloration and 100% dead embryos. And then as the bull aged, you can see, and it was alluded to earlier, as you get down to about 22 to 28 days, all of a sudden the bull is no longer sensitive to appreciable damage by the pantoa pathogen. And the same in general applies to other bacterial pathogens, but not necessarily fungal pathogens. If you put Fusarium semitectum in at that 28 or 29 days, it still would proceed to colonize and rot. When we went to the insect caging experiments, we discovered a new fellow that we hadn't encountered up to this point. This is a spread plate from a suspension of single seed, and then spread on PDA media laced with all kinds of antibiotics to suppress bacteria. And what we saw was a preponderance of these small slimy colonies. And if we went onto a bacterial media like TSA, these things appeared identical to bacteria as far as the surface appearance of the colony was concerned. Here you see the ragged edges. Those are actually due to rudimentary hyphae, very primitive hyphae coming from those colonies, but being coated by slimy bud cells. What we discovered is that this organism is the yeast, Nematospora coralli. And what I'd like to convince you today is that through the southern part of the belt, this is a major actor, a major organism being transmitted. It has very specific relationships with the insect. You were talking about fungicides. When the insect arrives at the cotton field, it's already got this organism internally. So external applications of fungicides are going to do no good because it's going to immediately feed, and when it does, it injects this fungus into the bowl. It transmits it with amazing percentage of success, so much so that we can't mimic it with needle punctures. The insect is much more effective at transmitting this fungus than we are with a puncture. This is a very unique fungus. It grows as bud cells. It can form a very primitive hyphae on certain media, but it forms asci that are born freely. And the asci have the characteristic needle-shaped spores, which is the basis for the word nemata, or the basis of the nemata bait. And if we look at these under the microscope, this is what you see. The bud cells are a little more rounded than the drawing, but you can see the eight ascospores within the ascus. If you inoculate with this fungus under greenhouse conditions, it almost always causes restricted opening of the bowl. And I think this is where it causes a real problem in the field. The infected locks will not, the suture does not split readily, and the bowl will only open partially. Consequently, it can hold moisture. And what we find is the bacteria secretes copious amounts of vitamins. The yellow discoloration is actually due to riboflavin, the vitamin riboflavin, which commercially is made from this fungus. And in addition, it will give some stunning, but it also secretes a mucilage material. And that mucilage material causes the lock to hold moisture longer and makes it much more vulnerable to other fungal infections, such as like Verticillium verticillioides or Alternaria alnata, Classiflorum herbaceum even, will selectively colonize these locks that are previously infected by nematospora. This shows in 2009 from Florida. We found a tremendously high incidence of this organism in Florida, in Central and South Texas. You can see the insect punctures there. This particular lock, all the damage you see there is due completely to nematospora. There were no other microbes in there. Most commonly, you will find other bacteria associated, some virulent, some avirulent. But in many cases, you'll find nothing but nematospora coralli. When the locks open in greenhouse under greenhouse conditions, you can see there's a partial restriction. I don't know if we call this a tight one, a hard one, or what, Bob, because it's tight in the middle and loose on the ends. But the interesting thing is that it appears this organism is killing, is causing disruption of embryo development in seeds. So if you look at a profile of the seeds, some of them, the embryos are dead, maybe 30%, and then you see a continuous degradation where the normal embryo size is only 20% of normal or 40% of normal. And it appears that when infection occurs, the embryos are being disrupted in development or even killed very quickly after the fungus gets into the bowl. The other thing we're finding is that this is a major, this infection causes a major drop in Micronaire only. And of all the fiber quality properties, we see nothing changed but Micronaire. And the Micronaire drops can be tremendous. This is a mean of three different bulk samples that were artificially inoculated. And of course, there's been some low mic problems like this showing up in association with insects in Georgia and in Florida. So we think, again, that's evidence of that yeast having a major role. In 2005 and 6, we looked at the efficacy of different insects to transmit this yeast, as well as bacteria. And you can see here in 2005, for example, from field bowls, we found that 34 of 36 were punctured, and 30 of those 34 had nematospora infections. Only 12 of those 34 had bacterial infections. That is, they contained bacteria capable of causing disease or bowl rot or lint stain. Nearly all those bowls will have other bacteria, but they're avirulent bacteria. Again, in the greenhouse bowls, where we caged the southern green stink bug that was collected from millet, you can see, again, a very high percentage of the punctured locks had nematospora in them, again, more so than bacteria. And in other greenhouse bowls from a light trap, again, you can see when we collect them from the light trap, we did see somewhat of a lower incidence of nematospora than when they came from pearl millet. And this has been a constant thing. We've seen that insects off of pearl millet are almost 100% infested with nematospora, and they transmit 100% when put on a cotton bowl. This in 2006, similar picture. Again, a lot of nematospora. In this case, it didn't matter whether it was from, and then now we were including other insects. We were looking at the brown stink bug, and we were especially surprised with the leaf-footed plant bug. Of 8 punctured locks, 7 of them yielded nematospora. This we almost never find Pantoa with this insect. It seems to have a very specific relationship between with a virulent bacillus species that caused no problem and the infectious yeast. Brown stink bugs are interesting because they vary tremendously from year to year. Some years, a high percentage of them will have Pantoa. Other years, you don't see hardly any Pantoa with them. But they pretty consistently are carrying nematospora. One of the interesting things is these insects that carry nematospora coming in from the field often are more voracious feeders when we cage them on a bowl than the insects that do not have it. So it appears to be a synergistic relationship. This shows some of the data we've gathered from the different states in 2006, and we've gathered similar data since. But again, as you see, as we move down from North Carolina to Florida, get more and more tropical, you see more and more nematospora occurring in association with the infested bowls. The non-punctured bowls, we never have, I don't think, Gino, we've never seen nematospora in an unpunctured bowl. When we've seen it and we thought the bowl was unpunctured, we preserve the carpal walls, we go back with the microscope, we find out there, in fact, was a puncture. Sometimes the only evidence you see of a puncture is disrupted cuticle wax or the disruption of the cells of the endocarp. There's not always a water-soaked spot there or an external necrotic spot. 2009 observations, 48 of 51 punctured bowls from Florida were infected with N. coli this summer. About 25% of the stink bugs, our previous speaker alluded to the fact we were doing these studies with insects from Georgia transported to Texas. 25% of the brown stink bugs from corn in Georgia transmitted N. coli to healthy green bowls in Texas. So when these guys moved off of corn, even though that was the lesser damaging crops, there was still a highly significant number of them carrying N. coli. I don't have data on the peanuts or on the soybeans. Hopefully in another year we will have more. But both of those crops are known hosts of this yeast. So I would suspect that insects coming off of them are carrying even much higher percentages of it. About 80% of the punctured bowls we looked at in Texas, in the upland farm and the Brazos bottom, were infected with N. coli. So as I think this is a major primary internal bowl, setting the stage at least. Once those bowls crack, there are other organisms coming into play that are probably further deteriorating fiber and causing the damage we're seeing. They've spoken already about this kind of data may help us establish better thresholds, but what we're interested in is this opening up an avenue to attack these problems with host plant resistance. So in 2006, we looked at over 100 cultivars that were in the uniform variety trials to see how they responded to inoculations at 12 to 16 days with N. coli. There were about 7 or 8 reps within each cultivar. But you can see there is an extreme amount of variation here. There were some that reduced had only a 1 to 10% reduction in the seed cotton weight as a consequence of inoculation. Others lost as much as 91 to 100% of the seed cotton weight as a consequence of inoculation. Some of those, for example, in the 8190 category, I remember there's Stoneville 5599, the nematode resistant line, is one that's extremely susceptible to N. coli damage. On the other hand, in the 110 range, there was the Delta Pine 444 was one that showed very little damage. So, and these were highly significant differences based on the reps we had. So I think there is genetic potential here to alleviate some of this damage through breeding. The other one I want to briefly mention, we presented this paper in detail at the World Conference 2 years ago, but our studies with adult flea hopper show a very specific microorganism insect relationship. This is your flea hopper. It has a very elongated feeding apparatus, long stylet. And when we look at mature flower buds that have abscised following caging, we did a lot of caging. These are caging experiments with this insect where we caged it over squares at various stages of development. And when we caged over flower buds that were pretty well developed, what we looked at is when these flowers abscised, without exception, we found the ovary was rotted. You also would see some anther damage, but the ovary was always rotted. When we did some comparisons then of the frequency of rot of the ovary walls in flower buds or young bowls with the rotting phenomena, what we found is the flower buds or the bowls that were retained after caging, none of them showed any rotting of the ovary walls. On the other hand, nearly all of the abscised buds or bowls did show rotting of the ovary. Now, some of these we think probably abscised. The exceptions there are due to abscission for physiological reasons rather than pathological reasons. But clearly, I think the infection of the ovary here is leading to the abscission of the buds as well as to the young bulls. This simply shows there is a very high correlation of a Pantoa species with this ovary rot and bow abscission. In this case, you can see, for example, in insects that were recovered from the rearing cage or from the cotton cage, nearly every one of them was infected or infested with Pantoa. Same way, when we examined the cotton buds that have sized or showed damage, again, we got the Pantoa. We have done a rather elaborate microbiology and molecular biology studies of these isolates. These all belong to Pantoa we know as Pantoa ananatus. Pantoa ananatus, of course, was originally discovered as the cause of the pink rot of pineapple. All of you who eat pineapples one time or another cut the pineapple open and saw that mushy pink middle. This is the bacteria that does it. It also has a fairly wide host range. It occurs on a number of other plants as well. But previously, we did not know that it occurred or was a problem on cotton. And you can see that using the 16S-R DNA analysis, it's a perfect molecular fit with Pantoa ananatus type strain. There is a little bit of variation in some of the isolates that we recovered, as exemplified by the bud 21 and the flea hopper 14 isolates. Our conclusions are that the internal bull rots frequently result from microbial pathogens introduced by feeding of hemipterous insects. Special synergistic relationships have developed between hemiptera and pathogens, especially plant bugs and nematospora, cotton flea hoppers, and Pantoa ananatus. And understanding these insect-pathogen relationships may allow us to set better thresholds for insect control and develop host resistance by targeting the vectored pathogen. That's as far as I'm going today. There is another major player group in here, and that's the Bacillus species. We're still working on them, but some of the hardlock, particularly the hardlock type damage we see, the very brown discolored hardlocks, are being caused by Bacillus species, particularly Bacillus pumilus. But Bacillus subtilis also has a number of strains, and it's very interesting that all of the subtilis strains that have been released for biocontrol are all excellent cotton boll rotters when delivered by the insect. We want to, since we do have that, we want to make sure this work is very carefully done and adequately documented with molecular studies too. So hopefully you'll hear from that in another year. Thank you.
A couple of questions.
How do the skin bugs affect
You're going to address this, aren't you? I think Dr. Medrano is going to address that in the next talk. Yes, David. I would like to guess that it's alcohol tolerance, ethanol tolerance. I think most of the staining comes from riboflavin and the breakdown of riboflavin. But I think the killing of the embryo and the disruption of embryo development is probably due to alcohol. This is a yeast. It's closely related to the alcohol fermentating yeast. So I imagine it, and it takes less than 1% alcohol to seriously damage, you completely prevent cottonseed germination with 0.5% ethanol. The cotton plant is that sensitive to ethanol. So, but that's more of a guess than a hypothesis right now. But I strongly suspect that we're going to, when you look at what happened, that nothing happens to fiber quality other than the drop in mite, which simply says the embryo got disrupted and developed or killed early. Don't get your developing cottonseed drunk. And alcohol tolerance may be what we're looking for. Yes, it may be very well be. We certainly know that this is true of Homo sapiens. The American Indian is extremely sensitive, or at least the Sioux and Santee are extremely sensitive to alcohol. The Caucasians from Europe were not. So, I might add, I grew up in northern Nebraska, where one of the activities during the county fair was to give an Indian a free beer because it amused the whites that he could get stone drunk on that one beer.